Imagine knowing that for 1 in 10 people who are grieving a loss, their brain will literally treat their deceased loved one like an addictive drug. Like they are going through endless withdrawal from this person. It completely rewrites what we think we know about moving on.
It really does. It fundamentally changes the conversation. Because, I mean, for most of human history, we've just treated grief as this monolith.
Like it's all the same thing.
Exactly. You lose someone, you grieve, and the assumption is that eventually, the sharpness of that pain softens. But the data tells a vastly different story about what is actually happening in the neurological hardware of a really significant portion of the population.
And if you're listening to this right now, I know you don't shy away from the complex realities of how the mind works. You're here because you want to understand the actual mechanics behind human behavior. So our mission for this deep dive is to explore this absolutely fascinating article from the OOTW Journal. We are looking at the frontier of mental health, neuroscience, and, well, an entirely inevitable human experience, grief.
Which we're all going to face at some point.
Specifically, we're going to look at what happens when the brain gets trapped in that withdrawal state and how a completely unexpected catalyst, which is psilocybin, might offer a way to finally complete the process. Okay, let's unpack this because before we can look at a chemical intervention, we have to understand the specific shape of the medical problem.
Right. So the clinical term for this is prolonged grief disorder, or PGD.
PGD.
And it affects roughly 7 to 10% of bereaved individuals. So we are talking about millions of people.
Millions. Wow.
And for decades, I mean, these individuals were just falling through the cracks of the medical system. They were often misdiagnosed with major depression or maybe generalized anxiety.
Because on a superficial level, the symptoms look pretty similar, right?
Exactly. You see profound sadness, you see isolation, lethargy. But the psychiatric community finally looked at the longitudinal data and realized, wait, this is driven by a completely different mechanism. So in 2022, PGD was officially added to the DSM-5-TR, which is, the standard diagnostic manual for psychiatry.
But wait, how do they draw the line? Because, I mean, grief is inherently terrible and long-lasting for everyone. So what actually separates standard painful grief from prolonged grief disorder in a clinical setting?
It really comes down to two primary metrics, which are time and functional impairment. To meet the criteria for PGD, the symptoms must persist for over 12 months in adults.
Wow, a full year.
Yeah, a full year. Or 6 months for children. And the symptoms themselves are very specific. We aren't just talking about, waves of sadness here and there. The core feature is this intense, persistent yearning for the deceased that just completely dominates daily life.
It just takes over.
It does. There's often emotional numbness to everything else, a deep bitterness about the circumstances of the death, and just this pervasive sense that life is entirely meaningless without that person.
So it's this all-consuming state that just does not degrade over time.
And the physical toll of maintaining that state is massive. I mean, the research shows that individuals with PGD have highly elevated risks for PTSD, suicidal ideation, and severe physical ailments, too.
Wait, physical ailments? Like what?
We see increased rates of cardiovascular disease and profound immune dysfunction. The body is essentially just buckling under the chronic, unrelenting stress of an unending loss.
It makes me think about how the brain processes reality. It's almost like normal grief is like a painful software update.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Your brain's internal model of reality has to adjust to a world without that person in it. It takes time, the system runs slow, it's super frustrating, but eventually the update finishes.
You get a new operating system.
You have a new operating system. But PGD is when that software update freezes at 99%. And the system just keeps endlessly searching for a file that isn't there anymore, draining the battery until the whole computer basically crashes.
Yeah, and that mechanical failure is exactly what conventional treatments have really struggled to address.
Because they're treating the wrong thing.
Basically, yes. When a patient with PGD is prescribed standard antidepressants, it might blunt the generalized sadness a bit, but it does not fix the underlying relentless yearning.
It doesn't unfreeze the update.
Even complicated grief therapy, which is considered the gold standard psychological approach, it yields very modest results for a large portion of these individuals. A significant percentage just do not respond. The system stays completely frozen.
Okay, so if the standard tools aren't unfreezing the system, what is physically happening in the brains of that 7 to 10%? Like, why is their specific hardware failing to complete the update?
What's fascinating here is that neuroimaging has finally allowed us to look under the hood and answer that. When we look at the brain of someone with PGD, we see a profound dysfunction in something called the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN. We've touched on this before in previous deep dives. That's the network responsible for our internal monologue, right?
Right. It handles self-referential processing. It's where your autobiographical memory lives.
The story of you.
Exactly. The default mode network constantly constructs and maintains your ongoing narrative of who you are. Now, in prolonged grief disorder, the DMN gets locked into a rigid, inflexible loop.
What does that loop look like?
It rapidly oscillates between two extremes. On one side, an intense, agonizing yearning for the deceased, and on the other, an extreme emotional avoidance of the reality of the loss.
Wow. So they're just bouncing back and forth between missing them and denying it.
Exactly. The brain literally cannot integrate the new reality because the DMN holds an iron grip on the old narrative.
But why won't it let go? I mean, if the conscious mind knows the person is gone, why is the subconscious so incredibly stubborn?
To understand the mechanism behind that stubbornness, we have to look at a really pivotal 2011 study by Dr. Catherine Shear and her colleagues. This study completely changed the paradigm.
Okay, what did they do?
They took bereaved individuals, some with normal grief, some with PGD, and they put them in an fMRI machine.
Okay.
And while in the scanner, the researchers exposed them to reminders of the person they lost. Specifically, they use photographs and specific words related to the deceased.
Oh, wow. Okay, so they are actively triggering the grief while watching the blood flow in the brain.
Exactly. Now, in the patients experiencing normal grief, the fMRI showed activity in the expected emotional processing centers. The pain was visible, neurologically speaking.
That makes sense.
But in the patients with PGD, the scans showed something entirely different. They saw highly abnormal, intense activity in a region called the nucleus accumbens.
Wait. The nucleus accumbens, that's the brain's reward center?
It is.
That's what lights up when people gamble or use substances. Are you saying that, neurologically speaking, stuck grief acts like an addiction?
That is the exact mechanism driving this disorder. Even though the patient's conscious, rational mind knows perfectly well that their loved one has passed away, their subconscious reward circuitry has literally been hijacked.
Oh my God.
It is treating reminders of the deceased like a craved substance.
That is wild. So they are literally in withdrawal.
Yes. Every time they see a photograph, hear a specific song, or even just dwell on a memory, the nucleus accumbens flares up. It expects the reward of that person's presence, just like an addict's brain expects a chemical release when they see, you know, drug paraphernalia.
Right, but of course the reward never comes.
Exactly. The brain is left in this perpetual state of frustrated desire. This craving-like yearning entirely blocks the brain from processing the reality of the loss. The internal model of the world can't update because the reward center refuses to stop expecting the payout.
That is absolutely heartbreaking when you frame it that way, but it perfectly explains why time doesn't heal this. If your brain is trapped in an addiction-style neurological loop, just waiting it out isn't going to fix the hardware issue.
Not at all.
But if the problem is a rigidly locked default mode network and hijacked reward circuitry, how do you break a cycle that is that deeply embedded?
Well, you need a way to temporarily shatter that rigidity. You have to force the system offline so it can reboot. And that is exactly what psilocybin does on a purely biological level.
Now, if you're listening to this and you're picturing tie-dye, the 1960s, or recreational parties, you have to throw that stereotype out the window entirely.
Absolutely.
We are talking about sterile, highly regulated clinical pharmacology here. So what is the actual biological mechanism when psilocybin enters the body?
So psilocybin's active compound is psilocin, and psilocin is a 5-HT2A receptor agonist.
Stop right there. What is an agonist in this specific context?
An agonist is just a chemical that binds to a receptor in the brain and activates it, basically mimicking the action of a naturally occurring substance.
Okay.
In this case, psilocin closely resembles serotonin. So it binds to specific serotonin receptors, the 5-HT2A receptors, which are really heavily concentrated in the brain's cortex.
And what happens when it binds?
When it binds to these receptors, it triggers this massive cascade of effects that dramatically disrupts the coherence of the default mode network.
It scrambles the signal. It forces the DMN to just drop that rigid narrative it's been holding onto.
Yes. The network loses its tight hierarchical control over how the brain processes information. That rigid grip on that fixed yearning narrative of loss is just temporarily dissolved.
Yeah.
Suddenly, regions of the brain that normally never communicate with each other start lighting up and talking.
Yeah, here's where it gets really interesting, because a point the OTW Journal article made that just blew my mind is a vital distinction about what psilocybin is actually doing here. Psilocybin is not a sedative. It is not a numbing agent. It doesn't treat grief by suppressing the pain or making you forget.
Not at all.
Quoting the source directly, it, quote, creates the neurological conditions under which the brain can complete grief.
That's the key. We aren't bandaging the wound. The biological mechanism is actively reopening it in a sterile environment so it can actually heal.
And we have the data to back that up.
We have the cellular data to prove this is happening.
Yeah.
A really key 2018 study by Lai and colleagues looked at how psychedelics like psilocybin affect neurons. They demonstrated that these compounds promote profound structural and functional neuroplasticity.
Okay, how do they do that?
They do this by upregulating something called BDNF.
Brain-derived neurotrophic factor, basically Miracle-Gro for the brain.
Exactly. It acts as a fertilizer for neurons. It stimulates them to grow new dendrites and form new synaptic connections.
Mm.
And what's crucial for PGD treatment is the timeline of this growth.
Right. How long does it last?
This BDNF-driven neuroplasticity peaks about 24 hours after the psilocybin session, but the levels remain significantly elevated for approximately 4 weeks.
4 weeks. So you induce this temporary disruption, and it leaves behind a massive month-long window where the brain's hardware is suddenly flexible again.
Yes.
The frozen update is unfrozen.
Unfrozen and ready to be rewritten.
But that's just the biological hardware. Biology alone doesn't rewrite an emotional memory. So what is the patient actually experiencing during that window that rewrites the narrative of their grief?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to look at the clinical trials to see what happens in the room. The landmark study that set the foundation for all of this was conducted by Dr. Roland Griffiths and his team at Johns Hopkins in 2016.
Okay, what did they do?
They actually didn't start with PGD. They worked with 51 patients who had life-threatening cancer. These patients were experiencing severe existential distress and death anxiety.
Which makes sense because they are actively grieving their own impending death. So the psychological overlap with PGD is massive.
The psychological mechanisms are deeply intertwined. So in the Hopkins study, these 51 patients received either a high-dose psilocybin session or an active placebo.
What makes a placebo active?
That's a great question. Instead of sugar pill, the control group received a high dose of niacin vitamin B3.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, niacin causes a physical flush, a tingling sensation, and an increased heart rate. It makes the patient feel like they took a drug, which controls for the placebo effect of expecting a profound physical experience, but without providing any psychedelic effects.
Oh, that is an incredibly clever way to design the trial. So what actually happened to the patients who got the real psilocybin?
The results were staggering. At the six-month follow-up, 80% of the participants who received psilocybin showed clinically significant reductions in depression and death anxiety.
80%. I mean, in psychiatry, an 80% response rate for something as deeply rooted as the existential terror of dying is almost unheard of.
It really is. Mm. And we are not just talking about a slight improvement on a symptom scale here.
Right.
Between 60 and 80% of those participants met the strict clinical criteria for full remission at 6 months.
Wow.
And a parallel study conducted at NYU by Dr. Stephen Ross replicated these exact findings. But the most compelling data came from a follow-up study by Ajahn Leibs in 2020. They tracked down those NYU patients 4.5 years later.
4.5 years after a single session?
Yes, and the therapeutic benefits were sustained. 4.5 years later, the existential terror had not returned. The psychological shift was permanent.
That's incredible. And now they're mapping this exact protocol onto prolonged grief disorder.
They are. A pilot study published in 2022 adapted this model specifically for patients with complicated grief.
And did it work the same way?
It did. They used two psilocybin sessions spaced 2 weeks apart, surrounded by intense psychotherapy. The results mirrored the cancer trials perfectly. Significant sustained reductions in PGD symptom severity, improvements in prolonged grief inventory scores, and a drop in concurrent depression.
Okay, but I want to push back on this a little bit.
Sure.
We know the DMN goes offline. We know BDNF floods the brain. But what is the actual mechanism of psychological change? What is happening in a patient's mind while they are lying on that couch that cures a fundamental fear of death or, you know, the unending withdrawal for a lost spouse?
This raises an important question, and the researchers wanted to know the exact same thing. Across all of these trials, they analyzed the data to find the strongest predictor of a positive therapeutic outcome.
Okay, was it the dose?
No, it wasn't the exact milligram dose of the drug. It wasn't the patient's background, their age, or their gender. The absolute strongest predictor of long-term healing was the intensity of the mystical experience the patient had during the session.
The mystical experience, I mean, that sounds incredibly subjective. How do you quantify a mystical experience scientifically?
Clinically, they use a validated psychometric tool called the Mystical Experience Questionnaire, or the MEQ.
The MEQ.
Yeah, it requires patients to score their session on specific dimensions. So, did they experience a sense of ego dissolution? Did they feel a deep sense of unity with all things? Did they experience a transcendence of normal time and space? The data clearly shows that the patients who scored highest on the MEQ had the greatest and most permanent reductions in grief and death anxiety.
It's almost like, I don't know, a structural issue. Like the ego is scaffolding. We build this scaffolding of our identity, our attachments, our fears, and we basically live inside it.
Yes, exactly.
And when someone we love dies, it threatens to knock the whole structure down, so we hold onto it even tighter. Psilocybin temporarily dissolves the scaffolding. It allows the patient to step outside of themselves and look at the terrifying storm of mortality, but without actually feeling threatened by it, because the you that is normally so afraid of dying isn't there in the same way.
That captures the psychological mechanics of the experience really well. Much of what makes PGD so complicated is that the grief becomes hopelessly entangled with our own root fear of death.
Right, because losing them reminds us of our own end.
Exactly. The loss of a loved one forces us to confront our own mortality, which triggers an existential terror that amplifies the grief, creating that locked feedback loop.
And the mystical experience just breaks that loop.
The mystical experience bypasses the terror entirely. It doesn't give the patient a neat intellectual argument for why death is okay. I mean, intellectual arguments don't cure PGD.
No, of course not.
It gives them a felt, lived experience where the boundaries of the self dissolve. From that altered vantage point, they can encounter their loss and mortality itself with a profound openness.
Wow.
In the grief trials, many patients report intensely vivid encounters with the deceased during the session. They complete unfinished emotional business, and they are able to move from a state of frantic yearning to a state of acceptance.
It's just mind-blowing to think about, but a profound wall-dissolving experience is still just a catalyst. If you step outside the scaffolding and have this incredible realization, how do you ensure the walls of fear don't just go right back up the next day? Because biology naturally wants to return to homeostasis. You don't just take a pill in a sterile room and go home cured.
Absolutely not. And that cannot be stressed enough. Taking psilocybin without a clinical framework is not a treatment for PGD.
Period.
Period. The framework used in these trials and the one required for these results is known as the PSI model. That stands for preparation, session, and integration.
Preparation, session, integration. So walk us through what that actually looks like for a patient.
Sure. So the preparation phase happens long before the drug is ever administered. The therapist spends weeks working extensively with the patient to map out their specific psychological stuck points.
What do you mean by stuck points?
Like, what is the specific unresolved guilt they are carrying? What are their distinct fears about living a meaningless life? What are their avoidance patterns? This cognitive priming is essential. It ensures that when the psilocybin disrupts the default mode network and opens that window of neuroplasticity, the brain is primed to directly confront those deeply rooted issues, rather than just having a random, undirected psychedelic trip.
You're essentially giving the brain a highly detailed itinerary before it takes the journey.
That's exactly it. Then you have the session itself, which usually lasts 6 to 8 hours in a comfortable room with two therapists present, where the mystical experience actually occurs.
Okay, so that's the middle part.
Right. But the most critical phase is the third, integration. Remember that 4-week window of elevated BDNF we talked about?
Right, the miracle grow phase where the brain is highly flexible.
During those 4 weeks, the patient does intensive, ongoing psychological work with their therapists. The therapists help the patient process the bizarre, profound insights from the session.
Because it's probably pretty overwhelming to make sense of alone.
Exactly. They actively help them construct a new narrative about the deceased and rebuild their internal model of reality while the brain is physically capable of forming those new connections.
Wow.
As the OTW article notes, the session merely opens the door. Integration determines what is actually built in the space it creates.
If you just open the door and do no work, the old neural pathways, that old addiction-like loop, will likely to just reassert themselves.
Exactly right.
Which highlights exactly why this has to be a clinical structured process. Mm-hmm. And for you listening, it's really worth noting the practical reality of where this science is at right now.
Yes, the landscape is changing.
As of this year, 2026, psilocybin is still moving through the regulatory pipeline and isn't officially FDA approved specifically for prolonged grief disorder on a national level just yet.
Not yet.
But the landscape is shifting incredibly fast because of this data. Psilocybin therapy is already accessible through legal, regulated frameworks in places like Oregon under Measure 109, Colorado, Jamaica, the Netherlands, and Australia. The access is expanding precisely because the clinical data is becoming impossible to ignore.
If the larger phase 3 trials currently underway continue to hold up the findings from Hopkins and NYU, we are looking at a monumental shift in psychiatric care.
So what does this all mean? When we synthesize the neuroimaging, the clinical trials, the receptor agonism, how should we look at this research?
It means that for the first time in decades, we have a genuinely novel mechanism to treat a condition that destroys lives.
Yeah.
For the millions of people whose grief has become a permanent, life-threatening withdrawal state, we are no longer limited by the boundaries of traditional pharmacology. We have a way to access the neural architecture of stuck processing directly.
We're bypassing the locks.
Bypassing the biological locks that keep people trapped in their pain and restoring the natural trajectory of human resilience.
We finally have a way to help the brain finish the software update. It's not about forgetting the person. It's about letting the brain build a new reality where the love for that person can exist without the paralyzing yearning.
Beautifully said.
Which leaves me with one final lingering thought for you to consider. The source material noted that a core target of this therapy is death anxiety, that deep existential terror of mortality. If a single structured experience with psilocybin can so fundamentally rewrite our terror of mortality and loss, what would happen if society applied this not just to those suffering from prolonged grief, but as a standard practice for how we all approach the end of life?
Wow.
Imagine a world where we treat our inevitable encounter with mortality not as a medical failure to be managed, but as a profound psychological transition to be actively explored. If we can dissolve those walls before the storm even arrives, how much differently would we all live?
That is a profound question, and perhaps the most important one this research raises for our culture moving forward.
Something to mull over. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the neuroscience of grief and healing. Keep questioning the world around you. Keep looking for the connections, and we will see you on the next deep dive.